Okay, let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service of the United Nations here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 28th of April. And une fois n'est pas coutume, we will start quickly with the announcements before we go to the topics. So I'd like to just introduce the gentleman who's on my right, Ibon Villalabeita. Mm-hmm. I hope I pronounce it well, who is a new colleague from ILO. I give you the floor for a moment, Simon, to introduce yourself. Thank you.
Hello, good morning. Yes, well, just to introduce myself, my name is Ibon Villalabeita, and I will be working at the ILO. So whatever help questions you need, you can contact me at the ILO. It's our address over there is newsroom@ilo.org. So
thank you very much. And as usual, Solange will send an updated list of colleagues. So, and you're really in charge of news and media, right? Okay.
Exactly.
That's great, especially with the conference coming up. I take this opportunity. She's not here, and she doesn't want me to do that, so I'll do it anyway. I'll take this opportunity to thank immensely, since we are speaking about colleagues, communication colleagues in the UN family in Geneva, I take this opportunity to thank immensely Fadela Shaib. Fadela is retiring this week. And you know her. She didn't want honors. She didn't want thanking. But I think we really have to say this because she's been a fantastic colleague, helping everyone who has been accredited to the UN. All the journalists can witness of her incredible patience, help, support at WHO for many, many years. I think I remember her when she did her first briefing. I was still a tongue tied, and I've seen her growing, helping, supporting. She's a great colleague, and I really wanted to pray to praise her from this podium and thank her immensely for all the work that she's done to promote the activities of the WHO and as a member of the communications family in Geneva. So thank you very much, and thanks to Ibon, and welcome and. Good luck with your new functions. And I'll turn now to my left, to Jeanette, who also has an announcement for UNDRR. Jeanette.
Thank you very much. I'm here just to say a couple of new words about a new international day on your calendar. It's the International Day in Memory of the Victims of Earthquakes, and that will take place tomorrow and every 29th of April. Why this day matters? Earthquakes are among the most deadly of hazards between 2000 and 2019, over the space of two decades. Earthquakes and their related tsunamis were responsible for 60% of all disaster-related deaths. And it's important because the vast majority of these fatalities are actually due to building collapses and not to the shaking itself. So what does that mean? That means that there's a lot we can do about this particular hazard, safer construction, the enforcing of building codes, and in the case of tsunamis, early warning and early action. It's also important because they're relatively infrequent, and the longer time that passes between hazards, the lower the memory and the increase in complacency. So we've got three core main messages for the day: remembrance and resilience. We remember those who we lost, and we act in their memory to prevent future tragedy. Second, earthquakes are inevitable, but the devastation they cause is not. And third, simple, practiced actions and enforced building codes protect people and development gains. So we have a public campaign for the day. It's Drop, Cover, Hold On. We're working in partners with partners globally, such as the Great Shakeout, which is a global organization but US-based, to encourage twice yearly drills for member states and countries who are at risk. So we encourage drills to be run. We're running a number of events ourselves. There'll be a global commemoration in New York at the headquarters. They will run an evacuation drill and have an AR experience. There's also a large event in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, where they will commemorate a large earthquake from 1966, and the special representative of the Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction, Kamal Kishor, will be there and is available for interviews. We would like to encourage the media to report on the day. It's a new day, and we would encourage everyone to highlight local stories and, above all, find out where this worked. For disaster resilience. We have a number of resources available. There'll be a press release and a multimedia package, including B-roll, for anyone who would like to cover it or to request an interview. I'll be happy to take requests. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. Thanks for this information about this first international day. Very important. Any question to UNDRR in the room or online? Let me see. I don't see any hand up. So thank you very much for this. And we continue to distribute the information to all the journalists. Thank you very much. So let's now go to Port Sudan. UNICEF has brought us Sheldon Yett, the UNICEF representative in Sudan, who's calling in from Port Sudan. But Ricardo is also connected, and he wanted to start introducing his colleague. So I'll go to Ricardo first and to Sheldon then. Thank you. Ricardo.
Thanks, Alessandra. Good morning, bonjour, everyone. Over the past two decades, UNICEF has used its Child Alert series as a sharp, high-impact media product to shine a spotlight on some of the world's most urgent and underreported crises affecting children, from Afghanistan to Haiti, the Central African Republic, and along the Darien Gap. These reports combine hard data with frontline testimony and field evidence to present a clear, unvarnished picture of what children are facing and what must change. Two decades ago, we launched our first Child Alert when the situation in Darfur drew global outrage and the Save Darfur movement was created. Today, I'll pass the floor to our country representative in Sudan, Sheldon Yett, to launch our new Child Alert, shedding a light on the horrors facing a new generation of children in Darfur. Over to you, Sheldon. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you, colleagues. Can you confirm that you can hear me?
We can hear you and we can see you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, colleagues. 20 years ago, Darfur shocked the world. An entire nation of children became victims of survivors of terrible atrocities. Images of burned villages, death, and mass displacement sparked global outrage and action. And as always, children are at the sharpest end of the crisis. Today, as the war in Sudan moves into its fourth year, history is repeating itself in the darkest possible way for children in Darfur. Once again, millions of children are living through extreme violence, hunger, and displacement. But this time, the crisis is deeper, and global attention has not come close enough to matching the scale of children's suffering. Today, some 33 million people in Sudan need humanitarian assistance. More than half of them are children. An estimated 15 million people have been uprooted, including approximately 5 million children. Across the five Darfur states, more than 5 million children are facing extreme deprivation. As we did two decades ago, UNICEF is today launching a new Child Alert to raise alarm about the catastrophic situation of children in Darfur. Children are at a breaking point. Across the region, childhood is again defined by fear, by loss. Homes have been burned, schools and health facilities have been damaged or destroyed. Families have been forced to flee, often repeatedly, often with nothing. Children are bearing the heaviest weight of the war. In Darfur, children are being killed and maimed, uprooted from their homes, and pushed into extreme hunger, disease, and trauma. Nowhere has the impact been more severe than in Al-Fashir. Since April of 2024, more than 1,500 grave violations against children have been verified in Al-Fashir, including the killing and maiming of over 1,300 children, many by explosive weapons and drones, as well as sexual violence, abductions, and recruitment and use by armed groups. Even though the siege of Al-Fashir has ended, its impact continues. The consequences continue to shape the daily lives of children, both those who fled and those who are forced to stay. Yet violence is not contained to one city or region. Across Sudan, it is intensifying. In just the first 90 days of this year, at least 245 children were reportedly killed or injured. These are just the cases we've been able to document, but the truth toll is likely far higher. Behind every number is a child whose life and whose future has been irrevocably altered. Hunger has become another frontline threat. Famine conditions were confirmed in Al-Fashir in November of last year, and malnutrition rates among children have reached catastrophic levels in parts of Darfur, where acute malnutrition rates exceed 50% in some locations. Across Darfur, conflict has shattered lives and food systems. Health services have been attacked, looted, or forced to close. Routine immunization has been disrupted. Disease outbreaks remain a constant risk, particularly for children already weakened by hunger. Education has also been devastated. Of the nearly 4 million school-aged children in Darfur, over 3 million are now out of school. Schools have been destroyed, closed, or repurposed as shelters. And this crisis does not stop at Sudan's borders. Children are fleeing into neighboring countries. They're arriving exhausted, traumatized, and malnourished. Host communities have shown generosity, but services are overwhelmed and severely underfunded. Despite the extraordinary challenges, our team and our partners are staying and delivering, treating children for severe acute malnutrition, providing safe water, supporting mobile health and vaccination services, and delivering psychosocial support and learning in child-friendly spaces. But humanitarian action is being pushed to its limits. What is needed now is not abstract. We need predictable, sustained humanitarian access and presence across Darfur, not temporary openings, but the ability to remain and deliver consistently and safely. Movement must be enabled and not obstructed. Civilians must be protected, with children explicitly at the center of these efforts. Schools, clinics, water systems, humanitarian convoys must be spared from attacks. And we need urgent, flexible funding that matches the scale and urgency of this crisis. Today, UNICEF's 2026 humanitarian appeal for Sudan is only 16% funded, putting life-saving services for millions of children at risk. Children in Darfur do not need sympathy, they need the world to act now. An entire generation is at stake. Thank you.
Thank you, Ricardo, very much for this update on this very dire situation. I'll open the floor to questions, if any, in the room. Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Just a few questions on the child alerts system to make sure I get that right. Is it the second time that UNICEF is launching this child alerts for Sudan or globally? And what does it take for UNICEF to launch this child alert?
Sheldon or Ricardo, who wants to? Sheldon.
Let me ask Ricardo to talk about child alerts in general, and I'll talk about the situation in Sudan.
Yeah, I mean, is it the second child alert of UNICEF's history, or just second for Sudan?
Ricardo, you're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. Let me clarify. No, this is not the second child alert ever launched by UNICEF. This is the second one on Darfur. The first one was 20 years ago, actually our first child alert ever, two decades ago on Darfur. And then since over the two decades since then, we've had many other reports launched on different countries. And this is the second one on Darfur. So if you like, Darfur 20 years on, here we are with far less attention, as Sheldon said, and probably a bigger crisis in our hands, given the scale of displacement and the geopolitics and everything involving humanitarian aid at this point. Over to Sheldon.
Yeah, I mean, what is astounding to me, I was in Darfur 20 years ago, and we had every Hollywood celebrity competing to get on the plane, to get on the bus, to get in the car. Now we have absolutely no attention on Darfur, no attention on Sudan, given the scale of the crisis. And the situation is far more complex than it was 20 years ago. The scale is much larger than it was 20 years ago. But the silence of the world has just been deafening for those of us on the ground here.
Absolutely. Olivia. Olivia Lepotvin, Reuters.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Sheldon and Ricardo. A couple of questions. Do you mind just explaining exactly what the Child Alert does? Like, how is it different from kind of other bits of advocacy and reporting that you and your colleagues do? Just be really helpful to spell out why this is different. In terms of, I think you were saying violence is intensifying. I mean, is that actually what data is showing you, specifically, you know, violence against children? And just that stat, the 245 children killed in the first 90 days of this year, is that across Sudan or is that specifically in Darfur? Thank you.
Okay, Ricardo, over to you, and then I'll take the Sudan questions.
Thank you, Sheldon. Thanks, Olivia. Yeah, the difference with the Child Alerts is that they are really a media product. So we're focusing our goal here to give information to journalists and in-depth testimonies from the field with the multimedia materials that are part of the Child Alert report that come with the package and that are now available through our digital channels to really paint a picture, a more in-depth picture of the issues children are facing in these countries. And we try, of course, to feel the pulse in what the media is interested in and topics that are appealing to the media. And then we try and fit into that narrative. But with Darfur, as Sheldon explained very well, it's really an issue of lack of attention. And we're trying to kind of build that parallel to hopefully galvanize a little bit more resources and media focus on what's happening on the ground. Even though there's a lot of reporting, there's also a lot of other crises in the world right now, and that doesn't justify the lack of attention, but it definitely explains it. Over to Sheldon.
Yeah, we do think the conflict is intensifying. Of course, it isn't just confined to Darfur. The front lines are constantly moving here. We have the Kordofans, we have Blue Nile as well, where we've seen active fighting. And what we're seeing is also an intensity in the use of drones, drone strikes against humanitarian infrastructure, humanitarian convoy. We've had multiple cases over the last several months. We've had the feeling that no place is safe. Markets are being hit, schools are being hit, health centers are being hit. Our trucks carrying our urgently required, needed humanitarian supplies are being hit, despite the fact that they're well marked, despite that all parties to the conflict know exactly where our supplies are going. We talk to all parties, and they're still being hit.
Alex, Alexandre, pardon, je, non, j'ai peut-être une, non, non, c'est bon. Go ahead, AFP. Je pensais qu'il y avait un follow-up de Olivia, mais non.
Yes, thank you for this briefing. A question for Sheldon. You're talking about 5 million children who are facing extreme deprivation. Are we talking about hunger? Are we talking about access to health facilities? Would you be able to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, we're talking all of the above. You know, it's fine if you provide food to a child, but that child is not getting access to health care, that child is still facing extreme deprivation. And that child is not able to get access to social services or other life-preserving services. That child is still facing extreme deprivation. What is required is a package of interventions. Children need support, need help be treated from the effects of trauma. They need access to clean water and sanitation. They need access to health services. They need to be immunized. What we're facing is children that are getting none of the above, none of the holistic services that children require.
Okay, thank you very much. Don't see other hands up. No, so thank you very much, Sheldon, and thanks, Ricardo. Thank you for bringing to our attention this important alert. Let's move now to another continent, to the Americas. We have Paulo Cabrero, who has brought us Christian Torres Bermeu, the IFRC Deputy Regional Director for America from Panama City, to tell us about the situation 6 months after the hurricane Melissa in Cuba. Please. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, colleagues. Good morning. Greetings for Panama. Today, 6 months ago, Hurricane Melissa made landfall in coastal and fishing communities across eastern Cuba, affecting more than 2 million people and leaving widespread destruction, particularly in Santiago de Cuba, Granma, and Holguín. The storm destroyed hundreds of thousands of homes, affected more than 700 health facilities, and several disrupted water systems, with nearly 100 pumping stations impacted. Entire communities were left without reliable access to electricity, clean water, or basic services, and recovery has been slow and uneven. The IFRC and the Cuban Red Cross have decades of experience responding to hurricanes in the country, including Ian, Sandy, Matthew, and Irma. But few operations have been as logistically complex as this one. The response to Hurricane Melissa has taken place in the context of a prolonged arboviral epidemic, placing additional pressure on already strained health systems, and more recently, under severe energy constraints that are directly affecting the continuity of humanitarian and essential services. Across the country, fuel shortages and instability in the electricity grid have been disrupting transport, water systems, waste collection, and the delivery of health services. These are not secondary challenges. They are defining the conditions for recovery and resilience. For communities affected by the hurricane, this means that the progress is fragile. Homes remain roofless or severely damaged. Access to clean water is uneven and health risks persist, even as cases of dengue and chikungunya begin to decline. For the Cuban Red Cross, it means operating in an environment where every activity, from distributing relief to supporting health services, depends on access to energy. In the immediate aftermath of the hurricane Melissa, the IFRC launched an emergency appeal to support 100,000 people over 2 years. Although the appeal remains significantly underfunded, it has enabled us to support the Cuban Red Cross in assisting nearly 45,000 people with essential services, psychological support, and relief items, including hygiene kits, mosquito nets, and shelter materials. The water systems installed by our volunteers in affected communities have already provided millions of liters of safe water, supporting up to 30,000 people each week. Health services, disease prevention activities, and community-based support continue across the most affected provinces. 6 months on, the challenge is no longer only to respond, it is to sustain. To prevent recovery from stalling, the IFRC and the Cuban Red Cross has strengthened their operational approach to safeguard the minimum functionality of essential services. We have secured fuel access for Cuban Red Cross vehicles, dispatched the first photovoltaic systems and electric vehicles to the country, and are progressing with the procurement of roofing materials for damaged homes, which will be delivered as soon as possible in Cuba. I had the opportunity to visit Havana a few weeks ago. The need to address energy, sanitation, and transport challenge is clear, but so is the commitment of the Red Cross volunteers and the technical teams. In coordination with public institutions and key humanitarian actors, they remain active in eastern Cuba and across the country, distributing assistance as it becomes available and preparing the upcoming hurricane season. It is truly remarkable to witness how more than 40,000 volunteers across the country remain consistently available to support their communities, preparing for and responding not only to hurricanes, but also to disease outbreaks and other risks present in the country. We call on the international community to support this effort, not only to meet immediate needs, but to ensure that essential services remain accessible and the recovery can continue with dignity and predictability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christian, for this update. Let me see if there is any question for you in the room or online. Isabel Sacco, Spanish News Agency.
Good morning. Yes, I am with EFE, the Spanish News Agency. I would like to ask on more general terms of about the situation in Cuba, beyond the consequences of the hurricane, given the lack of access, as you said, of energy, fuel, and the shortages of electricity. How would you describe in the island the situation for the population? And if you would say that this situation is one of a humanitarian crisis, I mean, open humanitarian crisis. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The situation in the island is, with all the shortages, is very difficult. Especially, for example, we are focusing on helping the health services to continue working across the country despite the fuel shortages and, of course, the electricity instability in the country. And this makes us the urgent need to support this operation so we can keep supporting the continuity of these facilities, for example, with photovoltaic panels that are providing energy to the health facilities to continue the work across the country.
Sorry, I did my mic off. Dina Bisab, APTN.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. And I'm sorry I missed the first part. I don't know if you already answered my question. I want to ask, how does the U.S. embargo impact Cuba's ability to recover from the aftermath of the hurricane? Thank you.
Christian?
The constraints are making the operation difficult, as I mentioned in my initial part, but we are finding another ways to continue the support to the Cuban Red Cross nationwide. This means that we, for example, we have procured fuel to secure the operational skills of the national society, in which now they are receiving fuel and they can continue operation. But the situation is difficult, but we are making all the efforts with the available tools to keep the work in the country, especially in the affected areas, with the volunteers of the Cuban Red Cross.
Thank you very much. I see Isabel as a follow-up.
Yes, thank you. Just if you can be a little more specific on what I asked about, if you consider this as an open humanitarian crisis, and if you can describe also the situation on the about the access of food for the population. Thank you.
The situation, I insist, is quite difficult also because not only for logistical constraints, but also for the access to the affected areas. In this term, the IFRC and the Cuban Red Cross is proposing in the emergency appeal different ways to approach the situation to reach more people in less time with the emergency appeal, especially in Granma and Olin.
Thank you very much, Christian. I don't see other questions for you. So thanks for coming to the briefing to highlight the situation in Cuba. And let me now go to my right, to Tamina Keitan for OHCHR. Tamin, you have a briefing on the situation in Syria.
Yes.
Let's go back to Syria.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Our colleagues in Syria have just concluded a visit to Al-Hasakeh Governorate, in the northeast of the country, where they received first-hand testimonies and accounts of past and present human rights violations and abuses. These include reports of significant numbers of killings, enforced disappearances, arbitrary detention, and deportation of detainees. During the five-day visit, our colleagues were also informed that three mass graves had been uncovered in Al-Hasakeh last month, including one inside a former detention facility operated by Syrian Democratic Forces. Our team also heard testimonies from families of disappeared people, including children and women, who reported loved ones having disappeared while being detained by SDF or international coalition forces. The coalition says it transferred 7,000 detainees to Iraq, around half of them Syrians, in January 2026. We fear that many of them have no access to families or legal representation. Procedural guarantees, including regarding their transfer to another country or detaining authority, non-refoulement, and rights to fair trial for those suspected of criminal offenses must be fully respected, regardless of their nationality. Now, turning to the south of Syria, we are receiving mounting protection concerns for civilians in southern Syria, where expanding operations by Israeli forces occupying these areas are placing lives at risk. Rights to family life and privacy are being curtailed, and livelihoods, particularly in agriculture communities, have been seriously impacted. We have received reports of increased harassment and intimidation, detentions, interrogations, house searches, and movement restrictions. In the Quneitra governorate, Israeli forces have reportedly erected checkpoints, searched residential properties, and arrested and detained civilians. In February, Israel reportedly sprayed chemical substance on agricultural lands and restricted the access of Syrian farmers to their lands, in addition to shelling and that hit agricultural land. According to Syrian authorities, the Israeli military has arrested at least 250 people in the south of Syria, including children, since the fall of the former government. 50 remain detained, and some have been taken to prisons in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan. This raises concerns regarding arbitrary detention, as well as enforced disappearances in some cases where there is still no confirmed information on their legal status or whereabouts. In yet another worrying development, the Israeli government has approved a project to expand illegal settlements in the occupied Syrian Golan, with reported plans to bring 3,000 new Israeli families as settlers to the area in violation of international humanitarian law. We call on the Israeli authorities to bring an end to all violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law in Syria, to conduct prompt and independent investigations of these alleged violations and bring those responsible to account. The settlement activities in the occupied Syrian Golan must also stop, and announced plans in this direction must be halted. In another development, the opening in Damascus of the trial of former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and figures of his regime, mostly in absentia, is an important first step. Justice and redress for the hundreds of thousands of victims must be achieved in accordance with international human rights standards. The heartbreaking scenes of bereaved mothers in tears at the courtroom speak to the need for a victim-centered transitional justice process. Al-Assad, his brother Maher, and all those tried in absentia should ultimately face court in person and be held accountable for the full scope of the crimes and violations they have committed. Also significant is the arrest of former regime official Amjad Yusuf. The horrific massacre he orchestrated in the Tadamon neighborhood in Damascus in 2013 demands full accountability. Accountability must also extend to all parties that have committed serious violations and abuses in Syria prior to and during the war. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tamin. Let me see if there are questions for you in the room. No hands. Let me see. Olivia.
Hello, thank you very much, Tamin, for this. A few questions, if I may. Just on the mass graves uncovered in Hasako, can you just give some more details about that? I mean, is that new information that the office has received for the first time, or were you already cognizant that this? And who is responsible for these graves and why? Just a bit of detail and context would be really helpful. And just in terms of South Syria, do you mind just being specific about the kind of areas or towns particularly where you're seeing these first-hand testimonies, concerns that you outlined there in terms of intimidation and detention, increased harassment? Yeah, just think the geographic names of those areas would be helpful. And just a final question, in terms of the reports of the mass graves, I mean, what are the next steps? Will there be kind of further investigation? Yeah, it would be helpful just to get a bit of detail on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivia. First of all, on the mass graves, we don't have the full picture yet. We are trying to analyze what our team has seen on the ground. First of all, these mass graves are closed, so we could not witness them closely. Our team saw the mass graves, but we could not inspect them. Also, our capacities in Syria do not include the capacity to inspect mass graves, the forensic capacity that is required. What we know is that there's the one I referred to inside the SDF former prison in Al Shaddadi town, which contains reportedly from 9 to 14 bodies. So there are two other mass graves also uncovered. What is needed here is for the authorities, first of all, to preserve the evidence of any crimes or violations that have been committed. The people who have been killed and who are buried in these mass graves deserve truth, accountability, and justice for them and their families. So prompt and independent and thorough investigations need to be done by the authorities to uncover the truth about what happened and accordingly take steps towards accountability and justice and determine the responsibility of any violations or crimes that have happened. On your question on southern Syria, as you know, after the fall of the former government, the Israeli military moved to control more areas beyond the line of the ceasefire of 1974. I do not have the exact names of these locations or villages or towns. I can check with my colleagues and get back to you on that. Thank you.
I couldn't hear Alessandra, but I think
sorry. I wanted to give you the floor. Sorry.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Tamin. Just on the other two mass graves, you mentioned one in El Shaddadi town. Do you have the names of the other two areas or any other details in terms of bodies found, etc.? Any sense of time scale? How recent you think the graves are? I think that's it in terms of my follow-up questions. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Olivia. So on the mass graves, we have this one that I've mentioned in El Shaddadi town. There is a mass grave near the Al Malikiya checkpoint near the city of Hasake, and another one in the village of Tal Khalil. The most recent one was discovered in the Al Shaddadi camp. The information that we received suggests that the bodies were not older than 2 to 3 months. But this, of course, needs verification and investigation, and that is why we are calling for proper and thorough investigations in these mass graves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Alessandra, I have a question for another topic. Can I go on?
Wait a second, because I see that Olivia's hand is still up. I don't know if it's a remaining or it's a new follow-up.
Sorry, yeah, just one final question. Just in terms of how you're wording this, is this verified by the UN Human Rights Office, or are you currently saying that you've seen and had reports, just so I know at what level you're recounting this information?
No, this is not completely verified by our office. As I said, first of all, we did not have the complete access to the mass graves. We were informed, our team, our colleagues were informed about the existence of these mass graves by the people we have, or our colleagues have met with. And as I said, we do not have the sufficient capacity to inspect mass graves. And that is why we do not have that level of verification. Thank you.
Are there any other, Isabel, is that on Syria?
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you for the information, but could you be just more clear about the fact that you said that I understood that your staff saw the mass graves, but they are closed. So you, of course, you have may have no details on, but they exist. Is that correct? So they are there. Is there, because when you say that this information is not completely verified, it can be a little bit confusing. Thank you.
Yes, our colleagues actually saw the mass graves, but not from a close distance. As you know, when you're conducting a visit in the area, you can observe the existence of mass graves, but we could not go closer, we could not inspect the mass graves, and as I said, we don't have the capacity. And we were also, we received testimonies and accounts of people living in the area regarding these mass graves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I see that your briefing notes have just been distributed. So I don't see other hands in Syria, so I'll go back to Mohammed. Mohammed, you want to ask your question on?
Yes, thank you so much, Alessandra. My question will be about Global Summit Philatelia. As you may seen, the Global Summit Philatelia set sail again yesterday from Italy to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza. As you may remember, last year, activists on the boats carrying on humanitarian aid faced harsh and unlawful intervention by Israel in international waters. My question is, what is your call to Israeli authorities to ensure their safety and their uninterrupted arrival in Gaza this year? Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. Israel, as the occupying power in Gaza, has the obligation to ensure that Palestinians in Gaza are supplied with all necessities of life and to lift all restrictions to the entry and flow of humanitarian aid. The situation in Gaza remains very, very dire. As you know, there are severe shortages still of clean drinking water, food, cooking gas, and many other necessities. And this is amid a prolonged displacement of the majority of the population, including in makeshift displacement sites that lack privacy, protection, sanitation, hygiene. And this is leading also to increasing health concerns. So the Israeli authorities have the obligation to lift all restrictions for these life necessities and to allow the delivery of humanitarian assistance for the people in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin, for this. Yes, Alex.
Yes, thank you. Just one more question, Tamin, regarding what you said about the trial of Al-Assad and his brother and those tried in absentia. You said they should ultimately face court in person. Do you mean we have to wait until they are physically present to be tried? I just want to be sure to understand what you mean by that they should ultimately face court in person.
Thank you for that. Obviously, as you know, the trial is being conducted in absentia. Yes, everyone that has committed any crime or violation of international law must be present to face trial. That is something we hope to see.
Anyone else or on other subjects? I don't see any hands up. Tamin, thank you so much for these briefings, which actually conclude ours. The only thing I'm left with is to remind you that the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination will have a meeting with state parties next Thursday afternoon at 3 p.m., and the Committee Against Torture will close its 84th session on Friday. If there are no other questions for me or for other colleagues, I thank you all very much, and I wish you a very pleasant day, and we'll see each other on Friday. Thank you.